hate to cut that off. It's time to start talking. Welcome to Chasing Sounds. I know we have a new way to call things out because Bob sent me an email.
All I know is this, you're listening to KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming at KOOP.org.
Oh, I guess you missed the email controversy then. Yeah.
I'm on the list. I get all the emails. I don't get the truncated, like, collapsed version.
Bob was
all
almost
the
in
emails.
Tears the other night when I got here. He's like, we have to say KVRX now. And he's like, his eyes are welling up. I had to hug him tight and tell him it was going to be okay.
Did I miss an email? Oh my God.
You missed an email and you missed an emotional breakdown, which is more important because Bob is a tender dude. He's a tender
dude. Aw, Bob. I'm glad he took good care of you while I was out being gimpy.
He did. He made me little sandwiches.
Aw.
Not really. That would have been sweet. So, Chasing Sound, taking you from the land of bebop into the outer fringes of the 1970s. Now, everyone at some point was, you know, a fetus trying to take shape or just a twinkle in their father's trousers. But basically, we all had a point when we were less alive. And for many of us, that was the 70s. A lot of Kanye and I's friends weren't even born yet. We have a lot of friends who were born in the 80s. Kanye and I were born in the 70s. But, you know, I was born in 77. I wasn't really making memories till the early 80s. You probably remember some of the
70s. I was little, but I do remember.
You have some vague
weirdness.
Memories. But there was more to it than butterfly collars and raunchy shag carpet and what made it onto the Dazed and Confused soundtrack. There was more to it than that. There was a lot more to it. There were the outer fringes, the weirdness. When I started putting this show together a week ago, I came up with 3 hours worth of music, and it has taken me all week to whittle it down to 30 minutes worth of music because I talk so much. That's all I have time for. So tonight, I picked the best of my three-hour playlist to sort of highlight the or brighten the corners of the weirdness that the 70s had to offer. The first band we're going to start with is called iBliss, and they were a progressive krautrock jazz fusion band from Rhineland in Germany. They were founded as a quintet in 1971 by former members of Kraftwerk. Yes, that's how long Kraftwerk has been around. The former members of Kraftwerk were making a band in 1971. And there was another band that they sort of used a few members from called Organization, spelled like, you know, like the Wurlitzer organ. You know, think like Organization on your keyboard, your synthesizer or organ or whatever. They only recorded one album. This band did not last long, as a lot of cool footnote bands are. They just sort of make one big bang and then disappear. But the album was made in Hamburg with a notable krautrock producer named Connie Plank, who, before I researched this, I had no idea who that was, but apparently he or she was a notable krautrock producer for what that's worth.
Wow. You really know your stuff, Kurt.
Yeah. So the band they lasted from 1971 to 1973. The only reason I know of this band is because I used to make Christmas mixes for all my friends. That would be, you know, when you have a lot of friends in Austin, after you've been here a while, you don't want to go out and buy each one of them a rare book for Christmas or whatever. You just make something cheap. So I started making mix CDs, and I would buy wrapping paper and cut out a square off the wrapping paper and glue it onto a CD sleeve, and that would be your Christmas gift, the Chris mix. And my 2012 mix, I was looking for some deep tracks, some stuff that nobody had heard. I wasn't looking to hit you with Huey Lewis. Like, I was looking to hit you with something you had never heard of. And that was probably my biggest year, because I thought, what if the world ends? What if all those people are right? 2012 is the last year. This better be my best mix. And it really was. I was going through a breakup, and it was a gorgeous mix, the 2012 Chris mix. So one of the tracks I found for that Christmas mix was this one that I'm about to play for you now by iBliss. It is unique, to say the least. It starts off with 3 minutes of a band just vamping on straight percussion, and then all of a sudden you hear this guy's voice come in going, ah, 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 like a kazoo, and you're like, what is happening? And then all of a sudden these guitars just come in doing this guitar harmony that just seems so far out and so weird, and the whole thing is just weird but exceptionally grooving. It's something you can dance to. So we're going to kick off what I'm calling Oddball 70s. That's what my outline says. I guess that was the title I settled on. Oddball 70s. We're going to kick it off with a song by iBliss. This is off their one and only album called Supernova. Here we go. We'll be right back.
Pick one.
Okay.
Much fun is that, right? Easily my favorite Paul McCartney solo song.
Barrel of Monkeys fun, I'd say.
I know. So if you don't know about post-Beatles, there was a little stretch of time after the Beatles before everyone started to suck. And there were a couple of good albums. Paul McCartney had his first solo album called Paul McCartney, self-titled, but people called it Bowl of Cherries because there was a picture of a painting of a bowl of cherries on the front. And then he put out his second album, which is Ram. And then, of course, John Lennon had his first two solo albums, Plastic Ono Band and Imagine, which were both killer. So, and even Ringo was making pretty... Ringo was actually the first one to have a hit outside of the context of the Beatles, strangely enough. And George Harrison, All Things Must Pass, a triple LP of just killer songs, all the stuff that he didn't have a chance to put out while he was with the Beatles. So there was a time when you really could, and a lot of people did this, and John Lennon actually prescribed this right when the Beatles were breaking up and the whole legal thing was being settled. He's like, what's the big deal? It's just a rock group. If you want another Beatles record, here's what you do. Wait a couple of years after we all put out solo albums. Go get them. Take the best two or three songs off each one. Put it on one mix.
Yeah.
And boom, you've got a Beatles album. And he's like, that because that's what the Beatles have become. We're just separate entities writing songs, and they just pick the best two or three of everybody's output, and that's your Beatles album. And it's like, Ringo's going to play drums on all of our solo albums anyway, so it's really not that big of a difference. And he was right. For a couple of years there, you really could just call the best stuff off each thing and make a new Beatles album. So Ram is the proper title of the album. Ram On is the song we just heard, my all-time favorite Paul McCartney song. It was the second studio album put out by Paul McCartney after the Beatles, and it was made in collaboration with his wife, Linda McCartney. So this was the only album ever released under Paul and Linda McCartney, just like Plastic Ono Band was the only album that was like John and Yoko, I guess, is how that went down. So there's a little sub-theme tonight of husband and wife teams. There's one more track coming later that's another husband and wife team, which are actually a little bit more adorable than the ones I've just mentioned. But yeah, that album was killer. It came out in 1971 on Apple Records. And I just love it. It's one of those tracks that you never hear on classic rock radio, but when you do sit down and listen to it, especially with headphones, you're like, what a masterpiece. It starts with this ukulele, and then suddenly it just comes in with this thudding organ sound and this unique percussion. It almost has a Radiohead feel to it. So contemporary. Yeah. It really, really holds up. Beautiful jam. So, you know, continuing on with the weird 70s theme, we're going to get into probably the weirdest band to ever come out of the 70s, and that is saying something if you consider what happened in New York in like the late 70s. This next band is Para Ubu. Have you ever checked out their stuff, Kanya?
I don't think so, no.
You're not alone. Not a lot of people check them out. People did consider them to be like the perfect marriage of rock and roll and art rock, in that it was sufferable art rock. Unlike some things that are, you know, you have to have kind of a intestinal fortitude to survive certain art rock. These guys were a little bit more digestible and more fun. Para Ubu, they started, so Para Ubu and the band The Dead Boys. I don't know if you ever listened to The Dead Boys. They were one of my all-time favorite punk bands. So there was this group that sort of quote-unquote never existed in the mid-70s called Rocket from Tomb. They never had a record deal, or they never made it further than a demo. They made one demo. And to this day, there are record companies that just pick up the rights to that demo and reissue it on CD. So wow. It still gets circulation. And the reason is that the people that were in that band split up and formed two bands, Para Ubu, the artiest of the art rock punk out of New York, and you know, the Dead Boys, the most non-arty of the punk, New York punk from like 1977. Somehow this one band broke into the two weirdest, most worlds apart thing ever. And it's just for, you know, for fans of rock and roll, for audiophiles alike, it's just interesting. It just turns people on. They like the idea that this crazy band that never truly existed long enough to hit its stride broke into the two of the most interesting bands that could not have been more night and day. So we're going to play a cut off their, I like saying that. We're going to play a cut off their first album. The Modern Dance is the name of the song as well as the album. So this is the title track, I guess you could say. And it's weird. It's probably one of the weirder ones on my list for tonight, but I couldn't do Oddball 70s without playing this. It's one of my favorites, and I think you'll dig it. The vocals are particularly haunting. So here we go, Para Ubu.
She leaves it. Calvary cross. Pale faced lady, she said to me, I watched you with my one green eye. I heard you tell you need me.
Did you know that you can support Co-op Radio when you use Ride Austin? Nonprofit Ride Austin, created with Austin values in mind, helps harness the giving spirit of the Austin community. When you ride local with Ride Austin, you can round up your fare and designate Co-op Radio to receive your donation. For more information and to download the Ride Austin app, you may visit rideaustin.com.
Support comes from the 10th Centro Americanos Fest, the annual Central American Music Festival taking place Saturday, September 1st at the One World Theater. The festival features multiple musical artists from Central America, including Humberto Vargas from Costa Rica. Traditional Central American food and arts and crafts vendors will start at 5 p.m. Music starts at 7 p.m. More information at cacfest.com or by calling 512-387-0903.
Okay, thanks for checking out those PSAs.
Yeah, oh yeah, and yeah, you're still listening to KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby.
Nothing has changed about that. I haven't even checked to see how many people are listening tonight. That's how into tonight's show I am, even if it's just the two of us, Kanya.
Aww.
I'm so stoked to have you back. Bob always shows up wearing that same leather pantsuit. I don't even know where the hell he got that thing. Where do you even buy a leather pantsuit? He shows up smelling like Chanel No. 5, judging me for my playlists. But he does light up the room, though. I got to give him that. He's like a beacon of light on an otherwise cloudy day. So had you heard that track that we played before the PSAs?
I had
right?
not.
Hardly anyone has. So this guy, Richard Thompson, and his wife, Linda Thompson, started making records in the 70s, and they were really good. They were exceptional. And what makes this guy important outside of those records is what he did in the late 60s, which is he was the lead guitar player for Nick Drake, which is pretty, like, wow. If you need something on your resume, having played lead guitar for Nick Drake, probably the most important, you know, the guy that everyone, Elliott Smith, all those beautiful, breathy, Cat Power, all those artists, if you want to know what the source is, it's Nick Drake. He's the king of mellow, the king of right-hand finger-picking on guitar and just putting you into this beautiful, moody space. And of course, he died young like all the greats. But he made three records. One of them, he was so far gone, he didn't use a band. It was just him and guitar, his last album that had like Pink Moon, probably his most recognizable song. But he did do two albums with a band. And Richard Thompson played lead guitar on those. And he's known for his out-of-phase Fender Stratocaster electric guitar sound that was later made much more popular or widely appreciated by the band Dire Straits. I'm sure you've heard of Dire Straits. Yeah.
Everyone.
So the Mark Knopfler, the main guy behind Dire Straits, his guitar sound, think of Sultans of Swing, that sort of like chicken-picking, a little bit out of orbit sound. Mm. Richard Thompson was the guy who sort of invented that sound, and he did it by messing with the pickups on an old Fender Stratocaster guitar. So that album, I love. That's off of the album, I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. And then I think there was a follow-up album called Shoot Out the Lights. It was just a couple albums he and his wife put out in the 70s. Not like they sold a lot of copies, you know, and they were out of print for decades. But I heard this guy, he was on Mark Maron's podcast, and he was telling all these great stories about the 60s in England. He was there the first night that Hendrix played a club in London.
Wow.
And he told this great Brian Jones story, Brian Jones of the Stones, of course. So he's... Richard is sitting in the back with some other musicians, just like smoking cigarettes and drinking, because they didn't even know. That's how new Hendrix was. Like, nobody even knew, like, who's Jimi Hendrix? And then the show's happening, and Brian Jones comes busting into the back of the club laughing. And he's like, don't go out there. The floor is soaking wet. And they're like, what? Why? And he's like, from all the guitar players crying. It's like everyone talks about Brian Jones like he was such a space cadet, but it's like clearly he was a funny dude. Like, he was clearly a very charming and funny guy. So enough of Richard and Linda Thompson. We're going to get to the crux of the episode now. So the reason I bring up the 70s is I used to drill my mom about, you know, in sometime in the 80s, I suddenly became fascinated with anything that was before my time. I started collecting VHS tapes of Laurel and Hardy comedy, a classic black and white comedy, duos and trios, the Three Stooges, stuff like that. You know, George Burns and his wife, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin, Martin and Lewis stuff. I became fascinated with that, and really just anything that happened before I was born. I went through like a several year obsession with Woodstock the concert. I like, yeah. Learned every detail. I knew, it's crazy, at one point in junior high, I could tell you what time slot each band played for all 3 days.
Oh, wow.
Like the way a kid could tell you the Lollapalooza lineup from like 92. Like, I, for some reason, needed to commit that to my memory. And at some point, I was fascinated with this notion of this decade that had happened. I was born in 1977. That was the year Jimmy Carter was elected. So I started asking my mom, started asking my grandparents, what were the 70s? I don't remember any of it. You know, my first memory might have been a tail end of 1979, seeing a Star Wars movie or something at the theater when I was 2 years old, but really no recollection. And my mom attempted to sort of break it down for me. It was this weird time because of Vietnam. She's all the stuff that we were playing with in the 80s, we were like going to see Red Dawn and we had realistic fake guns and we were shooting each other in the yard with them. And my mom was like, there wasn't really a lot of that. Vietnam was kind of raging. So kids weren't in the front yard with realistic Uzis shooting at each other. You know, she said it was just different. There was a different kind of patriotism in that, you know, she tried to convey to me the whole spent possibilities of the 60s when all the hippies burnt out and got day jobs, and how it just morphed into this sort of this gross caricature of the 60s. But then, of course, from out of the ashes come these true artists who bring a voice to that disenchanted feeling of the wave breaking, you know, like Hunter S. Thompson talks about in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. If you look out over San Francisco at a certain, you know, during lavender hour when the sun's setting, you can almost see the point where the wave broke and the idealism crashed into reality. And so as I continued thinking about this through my life, I'm like, how do you get a president like Jimmy Carter? It doesn't just happen. So think about that. 1977, for the previous 100 years, there really hadn't been a president who didn't come up through law. You get a legal degree. You know, you maybe intern for some politicians. You get into criminal or state law or something like that. You run for a small office and you sort of claw your way up, stabbing people in the back until you're president. Jimmy Carter didn't do any of that. He came, you know, he raised on a farm, which is not unusual. One in three Americans came from farms up until probably the 50s. That was where most people, they grew up on a farm. That was normal. What was unusual was that he was an engineer. And as far as I know, there's never been another president who was an engineer. My dad's father voted Republican his whole life, except for once, Jimmy Carter, because my dad's father was an engineer. And he's like, the rest of those guys are just lawyers. They're all crooks. It's like, I like engineers. They think about things. Like, they think and they execute and they, you know, they evaluate. But of course, it was rough for Jimmy Carter. You know, gas shortages, fuel shortages, the hostage situation. It was a rough time for Jimmy Carter. But what led up to him is fascinating. All of the things that went down to make it possible. So starting with assassinations, JFK, JFK's brother, Martin Luther King. You have these assassinations. You have the Vietnam War. You have presidents two in a row lying to you, saying we're going to get out of this war. And it keeps getting bigger and bigger. By the time Nixon gets in there, he, instead of pulling out of it like he promised in his campaign, he's sending 10,000 more people in there. People are getting fed up with this. These protests start heating up. You have the Democratic National Convention in Chicago where there are riots and there are police brutally beating protesters. It's a crazy, crazy time. And to think things weren't split like they are now, that was the Democratic National Convention where they were beating up teenagers. So it's not like it was the whole red and blue thing. It was just generally everybody hating hippies. Mm. And you finally get to this point where people are so sick of it, finally Watergate, all this stuff just stacks up. But the one thing people don't talk about enough, I feel, was the Ohio State, you know, in Kent State, when the children were, college kids, right, were executed by the National Guard. This is one of the weirdest things in American history. It's not as though police and National Guard hadn't murdered U.S. citizens before. There were plenty of murders, but most of those were non-white people. And I know, just the way all of us feel, hopefully if you're listening to this show, a life is a life. It shouldn't matter.
Absolutely.
But somehow it did matter.
Well, especially like privileged white middle.
You have to be realistic. A life is a life, but it's like they say to news reporters, like you bring the story home to people when you show a face that looks like their daughter. So that's what happened at Kent State. There were college kids protesting in the most middle America, white bread place there was. And all of a sudden, the National Guard, it gets called in by Nixon's order, and they start shooting live rounds at these kids. And some of them were protesting. Some of them were just trying to get to class and were just running away from this.
We have the right to protest in this country.
100% you have the right to protest. And so what happens is, four students ultimately shot in the back, murdered.
Ugh.
And a photographer gets this shot of this blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pretty white girl kneeling over her friend who's just been shot in the back. And this blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pretty white girl, college student, who's probably 19, just a child, you know, for all purposes, has this face that is just twisted with anguish as she's looking at her best friend. I mean, how much more innocent can you get? You're going to class, you know, it's a beautiful day outside. You got your college sweatshirt on, and suddenly your best friend is laying there dead. And so Time Magazine, back when Time Magazine was actually edgy, put this on the cover, and it just changed people. Suddenly, you can see how you get a president like Jimmy Carter. People finally saw that and like, enough of this stuff, enough of this Vietnam, enough of these crooks, these liars, these people shooting. You want to shoot our kids in the back while they're going to college? And so now I want you to put it into musical context. So David Crosby and Neil Young are sitting, hanging out in a room, just doing what hippies do. And they've got this copy of Life magazine with this photo, and they're just, all of a sudden, they're crying. They cannot believe what they're looking at. They're reading the story. They're digesting the news. You know, there wasn't internet or the 48-hour news cycle. So this news sort of trickled out to people. At first, it was a local story. Then it became a national story when it made the cover of Time and Life and all that stuff. So Crosby hands an acoustic guitar to Neil Young. He's like, you've got to write about this. You've got to write something about this. People need to hear about this in a way that makes sense to them. So Neil Young quickly just writes a verse, half a chorus, and it's so good that David Crosby just starts calling their manager, and he's like, book us a studio. And he's like, which studio do you want? He's like, I don't care. You get any studio that's open, and we're going there right now. So the band gets down there. They rehearse through this thing, tighten it up. When you hear the song, you'll hear it's not really a finished song. This is the sound of people desperate to get something together and out there. And it's one of the most heartbreaking songs because it captures it. The first lyric that comes to you is, 10 soldiers in Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. You know, and the idea that we're finally on our own, that means that not even your pretty, white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed daughter on her way to college is safe anymore. Like, this is murder, and it's no one is out of bounds, or no one is out of limits.
It's not just those people
exactly.
over there.
It's not just the black kids. It's not just the Mexican kids. It's not just whatever marginalized group you want to fill in the blank with. It's everybody. We're all in this together. Like, we are on our own now. And it became, you know, they recorded it and released it within a week of it being written. It's in the charts. I think the top position it got was like number 14 in the charts. It was a monster hit, and it just spoke to people. It, you know, I can barely listen to this song without tearing up because you can just hear what a country must have been going through at that time. And when I asked my mom what were the 70s like, that's what I really wanted her to tell me. I don't think she ever got around to telling me that, but that's what I was digging for. I was looking for the marrow of it, what made this decade so unlike any other. And I think that's what it was. It was, you know, the stuff hit the fan. Like, it just got real all of a sudden, so...
I was into classic rock, and I remember the first time I heard this song, it blew me away, and I had
and
to
you
ask
don't even
my mom,
know.
I was like,
yeah.
Mom, what is that about? What? Is that real? They do that?
Four dead in Ohio, and they're just screaming it at the end of the song, like, how many more? Four dead. And you're like, what does that even mean? You know?
Right.
It's crazy. And then it somehow falls under the umbrella of classic rock, but it's...
Well, I was in
It's more than that. It's But you're right. It makes the rounds on classic rock because that's how good of a song it was. But it's more than that. It captured a moment in time that changed people in a way that they can never look back from. And if you need a one song, 3-minute answer to the question, how does Jimmy Carter happen? This song explains it to you. So here we go. Four Dead in Ohio.
Rogers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. Fort Head in Ohio. Fort Head in Ohio.
Fort Head
in Ohio. Fort Head in Ohio. Fort Head in Ohio.
Fort Head
in Ohio.
Fort Head
in Ohio.
Fort Head
in Ohio. Fort Head in Ohio.
Thank you.
say.
All right. That was Japan. I was just trying to explain to Kanye who that band was. It's crazy how big they were, and yet hardly anyone talks about them in the United States. But they were huge in the 80s, right around the time of that, I don't know what you would call it. Some people will call it pansy rock, like The Cure, New Order, that sort of, you know, that gothic kind of trippy stuff that was very popular in the early to mid 80s. And Japan was just as big as any of those bands. They were a stadium act, played huge places in Europe. The first album of theirs I got my hands on was an import cassette that I bought at Tower Records over on the Drag. It's called Oil on Canvas. So that one, Oil on Canvas, I think came out in 84, and that was probably their biggest album. They were never as big in the States, but still a lot of people in the States liked them because they fit that mold of The Cure that was so hot for a minute there. But that track was off their first album. So that band got together probably around 1974, and by early 78, they had released their first album, The Killer, but unfortunately titled Adolescent Sex, which to them, I guess, was just capturing the idea of like how awkward and energetic it is when two teenagers are like messing around for the first time. And these guys, in their defense at that point, they were just kids themselves when they made this record.
Right.
But certain countries refused to stock the album. Record label reissued it.
Because teenagers never have
sex. Exactly. We don't want to think about what teenagers do in the back of cars or in movie theaters. So in a lot of countries like Canada, of course, they just released it as Japan, self-titled. But the album, the copy that I have is the original with Adolescent Sex as the title. And it is good. It was probably recorded in like late 78, came out just the very beginning of, or late 77 and released early 78. And boy, does it not sound like the 70s, right?
Yeah.
A lot like Joy Division. You think about Joy Division's first album came out in like 78, 79. And boy, does it not sound like the 1970s. There's just, or the Sex Pistols even. It's like some bands were ahead of their time and they were already writing the book for what the 80s were going to be. And Japan were one of those bands. And it's a crime that you don't hear more about them. We're running out of time tonight. We're hopefully going to get to squeeze in two more, but we're at least going to play this one. My favorite of tonight, Oh Sister by Bob Dylan. This is off the album Desire. It is surprisingly the 17th studio album that Bob Dylan put out, and he was just barely into his career. I think this one came out right after Blood on the Tracks, which was sort of his rebound album, his, you know, the brilliant breakup album that had Tangled Up in Blue. Desire was him and a country band getting together with a couple of female country singers. It was Emmylou Harris and Ronnie Blakely, two famous leading ladies of the country music scene at that time. They all filed into some barn somewhere with endless amounts of tequila and just drank and recorded live. Just all this, when you listen to it, you're like, man, there's nothing overdubbed here. These cats are all just knocking it out in real time with a head full of tequila.
Wow.
And it's not just backing vocals by these two girls. They're singing lead vocal along with Bob Dylan, which I really like that. Actually, let me load this thing up.
Yeah, I didn't realize. So I'm familiar with Emmylou Harris. I'm not familiar with Ronnie Blakely, but I had no idea she had sang backup on these songs. And I know all of these Dylan albums.
It's weird. It's like backup lead. When you listen to Desire, he's almost always like One More Cup of Coffee, songs like that. Mm. He's got this dominant female vocal going right along with him, like sort of co-writing on the main lyrics. And this is one of my favorite Dylan albums. Again, people don't talk about it enough, but it is just, it's just got this razor clarity to it and this beautiful imagery. And the recording sound of it, it's got that old country sound that Bob Dylan was always so fond of, that just very much live and in the moment kind of twang. And yeah, we're going to play Oh Sister, one of my favorites off an album that really doesn't have a bad song on it. And then maybe we'll get, if we have enough time, we'll play Tom Waits. I doubt it though. So we might be signing off on this one. And we want to thank everyone for listening right here at KOOP.org to another episode of Chasing Sound. This is Oh Sister. Thank you.
to lie in your arms. You should not treat me like a stranger. I bother when I like the way that you act, and you must realize the day. A brother to you, and one deserving of affection. And is our purpose not the same on this earth? To love and follow his direction. Tomorrow.